To badquaker.com podcast. Today is Monday, March 12th, 2012, and this is podcast number 118. And today again is going to be a rerun. I'm cheating. Yeah, I am. It's a compilation of several articles that were from last year, and I hope that hope you enjoy them. And we'll get back with regular podcasts probably tomorrow or as quickly as possible. Thanks a lot, and enjoy the articles. Property, the tragedy of the commons. I'm starting this series on property by jumping into the middle of the topic rather than establishing a base and then building on it. My reason for this approach is that since socialism has crept into so many aspects of our lives, it's often hard to recognize it when we're looking right at its devastating consequences. This familiarity with evil causes us to accept the notion that some things are the way they are by nature, so we don't see the cause-effect aspect of the problem. Having failed to identify the problem's source, we are more easily sold a statist, socialist solution without even realizing it, which, of course, makes the problem worse. So then, by directly confronting the primary effects of socialism, among which are overusage, shortage, hoarding, and ultimately rationing, it's my hope to sharpen the reader's skill at spotting the lies of socialism whenever they appear. Ketchup. Four college students, Tom, Bill, Fred, and Larry, decide to move off campus and rent a house. This seems to make sense because it will afford them more individual space and free them from the rules of the dormitory. So a suitable house is found and they quickly move in, not realizing they're leaping into a social experiment that may render them all enemies fighting over a bottle of ketchup. On the very first day, Tom mentions to the others how funny it is to look in the refrigerator and see two jugs of milk, three bottles of orange juice, and four bottles of ketchup, yet there is no butter, cheese, or eggs. Bill suggests a budget be established and basic food supplies be purchased using equal contributions from each of the four, but specialty items that individuals buy for themselves be kept separate. Everyone agrees this is the logical way to avoid conflicts over what belongs to whom and who owes whom for what. Four cabinets are selected and designated, and zones in the refrigerator are assigned. They make a list of basic supplies, and each student throws $25 into a hat. Tom takes the list and the cash and heads to the store, all the time thinking how nicely they solved their very first potential problem. After some time passes and the newness of the house wear away, Tom begins noticing some differences among the group. For example, Bill usually skips breakfast, as he has an early class and can never seem to get up on time. Fred wakes up early and over the course of the morning consumes two or three bowls of what Tom considers kids' cereal. Larry wakes up mid-morning and has a three-egg omelet which he covers in ketchup. This strikes Tom as particularly odd since he's never heard of people putting ketchup on eggs. Seeing Larry desecrate his food in this manner turns Tom's stomach. The very thought of the mess is more than Tom can handle before he's had his coffee. Tom is not alone in his observations. Bill, who almost never drinks milk and only occasionally has an egg, is beginning to wonder why he has to continually chip in for more supplies, while consuming the least of the group. However, in all fairness, Bill is the one who made that first list, which included milk and eggs,
So he doesn't feel comfortable making a big deal out of it. After all, he tells himself, it probably all evens out in the long run. However, Bill is beginning to become frustrated with Larry due to his habit of leaving his stinky shoes wherever he flops down when he comes back from jogging every afternoon. And Tom is starting to get on Bill's nerves with his tendency to constantly be cleaning everything over and over. Larry doesn't notice any of the things that Tom and Bill are beginning to obsess over. He's never had so much fun. The freedom of being away from home and the excitement of living in a college town keep Larry smiling all the time as he enjoys this wonderful life with his new friends. Fred pretty much feels the same way. Having grown up in a large family, this is the first time he can truly have his own stuff and not have to share with his little brothers and sisters. The freedom to buy a bag of frozen curly fries, toss them in the oven, then sitting back in his room and watching what he wants to watch on TV while eating every bite without sharing one fry just thrills Fred. And he gets to have his fries the way he likes, very crispy and covered with ketchup and extra salt. Plus, he gets the same satisfaction from his Frosty Flakes in the morning. He can eat all he wants and never has to worry about someone else emptying the box before he gets up. Then one day, Tom was running the vacuum cleaner in the living room and had to stop to move Larry's shoes. Bill took the opportunity to point out that Larry is the only one that leaves his stuff lying around everywhere like that. While Tom agreed the shoes were a problem, he pointed out that Bill leaves his shaving supplies all over the bathroom. Bill had never thought about it like that, but in defense, Bill asked why it is that he's the only one who takes the trash out of the bathroom. Clearly, something has to be done about all this. About this time, Larry walked in from the kitchen with an empty ketchup bottle and announced that somehow all the ketchup is gone. Bill asked what happened to 4 bottles of ketchup. And Tom answered with a scowl that Larry saturates his eggs with it every morning. Larry was devastated. For the first time, he realized Tom's opinion of him, and it seemed these two were ganging up on him. He tried to defend his use of ketchup by saying that he only had a small amount each time, but to no avail. Bill agreed with Tom that it was time Larry made up for his ketchup consumption. So Larry put on his shoes and headed for the store. From then on, Larry made sure he put all the ketchup he wanted on his eggs. After all, he wanted to get his money's worth, and since he was getting blamed for everything anyway. After a few days, Larry was still angry about how his friends had ganged up on him. So one evening, he decided to treat himself to an omelet and just dare someone to say something. Except, when he went to the refrigerator to grab the ketchup, there was none. As it turned out, Fred had taken the bottle into his room to enjoy some curly fries and had failed to return it. So Larry accused Fred of hoarding the ketchup. Bill tried to calm the situation by suggesting a system of ketchup allotments, and Tom agreed that it sounded fair. But this was too much for Larry. He pointed out how Tom was the one who started this whole thing about ketchup on the very first day and how Bill's money schemes had led to these shortages to begin with. All of that, along with how Tom is always making noise, running the vacuum, is starting to get irritating. Oddly enough, before the ketchup issue, Larry was never bothered by Tom's cleaning routine. Ownership and responsibility. When you are the sole owner of a thing, you are solely responsible for that thing. If you damage it, improve it, or consume it, you only have to answer to you for the condition of the thing. But when ownership of a thing is shared, vagueness and layers of arbitrary rules fog the responsibility for that thing. The loss of responsibility manifests itself in overusage, shortages, hoarding, and ultimately rationing. And since shared ownership is contrary to human nature, anger and frustration are the typical emotions that result. In our example above, we see commodities like ketchup and eggs and milk being consumed disproportionately, while common resources like the living room and the bathroom are being abused or even polluted, at least this is the case in the opinion of some. We also see labor being misallocated, and we see the frustration and the anger that, when taken to the level of a nation, erupts in strikes, protests, marches, and in the end, state violence and suppression of individuals. But what we don't see is anyone upset about curly fries or Frosty Flake consumption. The difference being that the curly fries and the Frosty Flakes were clearly the property of one person. We also don't see shortages of fries or flakes, as the owner is the sole responsible party. The reality is that almost all conflicts boil down to property rights. When the right of property is correctly addressed, almost all other differences become trivial. The more individuals apply the principles of property rights to their lives, the less confusing and misunderstanding have a place in the conversation. This goes back to the old saying, good fences make good neighbors. The reason that statement has passed the test of time and criticism is because it's based on the natural respect for property rights and an understanding that the more defined the dividing line that separates your property from mine, the more comfortable we both are with that which we own. So then, what are the principles of property rights? Property is that which can be owned. First and foremost, that would include oneself. And in the same manner, you can own no one but yourself, and no one can own you. Age, health, or other physical condition does not alter this foundational truth. Others may be able to use violence or the threat thereof against you, but this does not indicate ownership. Additionally, there's only one of you, therefore you are in limited supply and you can only be in one place at a time. While you are in that place, no one else can occupy that space. Therefore, you naturally own the space you occupy, and since you are not divisible, one cannot rightfully share oneself. You have the ability to act. Unlike water or a rock, humans can choose to act or not act. Our actions can cause work to be accomplished, and the result can be more property. That property will have things in common with that which we have already established as property. It must occupy space and be in limited supply. When our actions produce property, we are the natural owners of that property. When we produce property, we have the right to keep, sell, trade, abandon, or give that property as a gift. Also, unowned or undiscovered property can become owned property by homesteading, which means mixing one's labor with the property and or occupying that property. Now, if we take this primary example of property and apply it to other things, we can begin to understand what can and cannot be property, and therefore what can and cannot be owned. Space can be owned. Since we own the space we occupy, and we can homestead new space. However, outer space cannot be owned because it is not in limited supply. So, only that space that has defined boundaries can be owned, as this characteristic creates a limited supply. If you could fence in some defined area of outer space and improve it or occupy it, you could own that defined space, but not all of outer space. The same goes for space that contains land. If its borders can be defined and it is unoccupied, unimproved, or abandoned, it can be homesteaded. Abandoned property has some exceptions to the above rules. A resource like wood is in limited supply. It occupies space. It can be produced by labor. Additionally, if I trade or sell wood that I own, then I no longer own it. Wood can be used to make fire, but fire cannot be property. although it appears to occupy space. If I bring the fire of one torch into the space of the fire of another torch, they can occupy the same space at the same time. Also, if I bring my torch to an unlit torch, I can share fire without diminishing the original fire. Therefore, it is not in limited supply and cannot be property. A thought is not property. It does not occupy space, and it can be shared in unlimited quantities without diminishing the original thought. Therefore, a thought cannot be property. When consistently followed, property rights produce prosperity and improve the human condition. When ignored or violated, consequences will always result. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Practical Bob and his practical jar of answers. Are you familiar with computer or video games? Well, I suppose that's a vague question, since there are a myriad of types of video games. I should be more specific. Are you familiar with simulation games, specifically world simulation or god games, where you play the role of the world or civilization builder? Oftentimes, these games start with a relatively blank canvas, and you choose how customized you want your world to be from a set of predetermined settings. So, for example, you may want a world with lots of waterways where you can build cities and towns that have an economy based on fishing and seafaring. Or you may prefer a forested world or a desert landscape. Or perhaps you want a combination where you can build competing civilizations dependent upon different resources. Many soothing hours can be spent building civilizations, developing their characteristics, and watching their advantages work themselves out. Most games have features that programmers call wizards, where you can overcome basic problems of a developing civilization by utilizing preset solutions that the wizard can do for you with some simple commands. For example, let's say you're developing a civilization that you want to watch move from the Neolithic Age to the Bronze Age. To do this, your civilization will need an abundance of stone, copper ore, tin ore, and enough food to provide leisure time for the people to utilize their skills on something other than finding sustenance. A wizard program can do this for you with preset functions. You simply launch the wizard and it solves the resource problem. No need to go all over your virtual world, placing ore deposits and berry bushes in random locations, hoping your little people can find them. A different example of a wizard was the annoying Microsoft Office assistant, Clippy, a feature developed for the single purpose of driving people crazy. In the case of Clippy, he could be set to appear only when you requested him, or he could jump into your screen randomly and attempt to humiliate and annoy you. Clippy was originally a part of a wizard program called Microsoft Bob. Yes, Bob was discontinued because he was a dismal failure, and eventually Clippy joined him in cyber purgatory, where they will burn in agony until they've paid for their annoying tendencies. But the concept is still good and has shown to be useful in a variety of applications. I was thinking the other day, and I came to the conclusion that a wizard would be handy to have when explaining anarcho-capitalism to those who are not fully comfortable with completely eliminating the state. Let's say you have a small program called Practical Bob. Whenever you're talking about liberty and you mention that the state is the source of a particular problem, and the other person says, "Yes, but without the state, we would have no roads and highways," Practical Bob would pop in and say, "It looks like you need a solution to the road problem. Can I help?" Then Practical Bob reaches into his practical jar of answers and hands the solution to the person. You see, when a person begins to contemplate the foundational moral axiom of libertarianism, the zero aggression principle, and as they come to grips with the depth of the meaning of property right, that person will either reject the core of libertarianism, choose to ignore the elephant in the room, or admit there is no moral justification for a state. Once they understand that the state is an entirely immoral concept. They are faced with the dilemma of keeping some part of the state for practical purposes or placing their hopes in some vague faith that everything will be just fine without a state. This can be a terrifying proposition. On the other hand, for the fully immersed anarcho-capitalist who is trying to help the new libertarians see that a truly free market can supply all of humanity's needs, having to back up and deal with simple issues like roads, water rights, policing, foreign threats, etc., can be frustrating. Who of us hasn't been that stereotypical libertarian listing book after book, insisting that if the other person would only read these 20 volumes and spend a few hundred hours studying Austrian economics, they would understand the power of the market? So, then, I propose that some industrious libertarian with computer skills create a phone app. By single prompt, Practical Bob would launch and ask what kind of help you would like. Then Bob would reach into his practical jar and pull out a soundbite from any of several popular authors. Example. User. Practical Bob. Bob. What can I help you with? User. Private security and police. Bob. I'm sorry. Please clarify. Rothbard or Molyneux? User. Molyneux. Bob reaches into his jar, pulls out the cover image from Practical Anarchy by Stefan Molyneux. A section on DROs begins to play, and you hear Stefan's voice. Additionally, a link to where you can buy the book appears. Or, user, Practical Bob. Bob, what can I help you with? User, IP law. Bob whips out Against Intellectual Property by Stephen Kinsella, and you hear Jock Coates' voice. Or, user, Practical Bob. Bob, what can I help you with? User, slavery. Bob, I'm sorry, please clarify. Slavery in a libertarian society or Lincoln and slavery? User, slavery in a libertarian society. Bob, out comes For a New Liberty by Rothbard, and you hear the voice of Floyd Lilly reading Chapter 5, Involuntary Servitude. With a wildly popular app like this, the next logical step would be to actually create a god game, with Practical Bob and his practical jar helping you build the perfect anarcho-capitalist world. Or, perhaps, Practical Bob as a drop-down feature in an MMORPG that would incorporate anarcho-capitalism in a rich online environment. I can't guarantee I would play such a game, but I could convince myself to cash the check if someone wants to write such a game and slip me some of the profits. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.
Okay, that wasn't so bad listening to a couple old articles, was it? We've got one coming up from Robert P. Murphy, and then there'll be another after that. But first, we're going to break for this commercials. For these commercials. For those commercials, the commercials, for our commercials. Thanks, folks. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks.
But wouldn't warlords take over? By Robert P. Murphy. Apples and oranges. When dealing with the warlord objection, we need to keep our comparisons fair. It wouldn't do to compare Society A, which is filled with evil, ignorant savages who live under anarchy, with Society B, which is populated by enlightened, law-abiding citizens who live under limited government. The anarchist doesn't deny that life might be better in Society B. What the anarchist does claim is that for any given population, the imposition of a coercive government will make things worse. The absence of a state is a necessary but not sufficient condition to achieve the free society. To put the matter differently, it is not enough to demonstrate that a state of private property anarchy could degenerate into ceaseless war, where no single group is strong enough to subjugate all challengers, and hence no one can establish, quote, order. After all, communities living under a state degenerate into civil war all the time. We should remember that the frequently cited cases of Colombia and now Iraq are not demonstrations of anarchy turned into chaos, but rather examples of government turned into chaos. For the warlord objection to work, the statist would need to argue that a given community would remain lawful under a government, but that same community would break down into continuous warfare if all legal and military services were privatized. The popular case of Somalia, therefore, helps neither side. It is true that Rothbardians should be somewhat disturbed that the respect for non-aggression is apparently too rare in Somalia to foster the spontaneous emergence of a totally free market community. But by the same token, the respect for, quote, the law was also too weak to allow original Somali government to maintain order. Now that we've focused the issue, I think there are strong reasons to suppose that civil war would be much less likely in a region dominated by private defense and judicial agencies rather than by a monopoly state. Private agencies own the assets at their disposal, whereas politicians, especially in democracies, merely exercise temporary control over the state's military equipment. Bill Clinton was perfectly willing to fire off dozens of cruise missiles when the Lewinsky scandal was picking up steam. Now, regardless of one's beliefs about Clinton's motives, clearly Slick Willie would have been less likely to launch such an attack if he had been the CEO of a private defense agency that could have sold the missiles on the open market for $569,000 each. We can see this principle in the case of the United States. In the 1860s, would large-scale combat have broken out on anywhere near the same scale if, instead of the two factions controlling hundreds of thousands of conscripts, all military commanders had to hire voluntary mercenaries to pay them a market wage for their service? Contract theory of government. I can imagine a reader generally endorsing the above analysis, yet still resisting my conclusion. He or she might say something like this. In a state of nature, people initially have different views of justice. Under market anarchy, different consumers would patronize dozens of defense agencies, each of which attempts to use its forces to implement incomparable codes of law. Now, it's true that these professional gangs might generally avoid conflict out of prudence, but the equilibrium would still be precarious. To avoid this outcome, my critic could elaborate, citizens put aside their petty differences and agree to support a single monopoly agency, which then has the power to crush all challengers to its authority. This admittedly raises the new problem of controlling the Leviathan, but at least it solves the problem of ceaseless domestic warfare. There are several problems with this possible approach. First, it assumes that the danger of private warlords is worse than the threat posed by a tyrannical central government. Second, there is the inconvenient fact that no such voluntary formation of a state ever occurred. Even those citizens who, say, supported the ratification of the U.S. Constitution were never given the option of living in market anarchy. Instead, they had to choose between government under the Articles of Confederation or government under the Constitution. But for our purposes, the most interesting problem with this objection is that, were it an accurate description, it would be unnecessary for such a people to form a government. If, by hypothesis, the vast majority of people, although they have different conceptions of justice, can all agree that it is wrong to use violence to settle their honest disputes, then market forces would lead to peace among the private police agencies. Yes, it is perfectly true that people have vastly different opinions concerning particular legal issues. Some people favor capital punishment, some consider abortion to be murder, and there would be no consensus on how many guilty people should go free to avoid the false conviction of one innocent defendant. Nonetheless, if the contract theory of government is correct, the vast majority of individuals can agree that they should settle these issues not through force, but rather through an orderly process, such as is provided by periodic elections. But if this does indeed describe a particular population, why would we expect such virtuous people, as consumers, to patronize defense agencies that routinely used force against weak opponents? Why wouldn't the vast majority of reasonable consumers patronize defense agencies that had interlocking arbitration agreements and submitted their legitimate disputes to reputable, disinterested arbitrators? Why wouldn't the private, voluntary legal framework function as an orderly mechanism to settle matters of public policy? Again, the above description would not apply to every society in history. But by the same token, such warlike people would also fail to maintain the rule of law in a limited state. Free riders. A sophisticated apologist for the state, especially one versed in mainstream economics, might come back with yet another justification. The reason a limited government is necessary is that we can't trust the market to adequately fund legitimate police forces. It may be true that 95% of a population would have similar enough views with respect to justice that such peace would obtain if they all contributed substantially to defense agencies dedicated to enforcing their views. However, the apologist would continue, if these police agencies have no right to extract contributions from everyone who endorses their actions, then they will be able to field a much smaller force. The market fails specifically because of the free rider problem. When a legitimate firm cracks down on a rogue agency, all law-abiding people benefit. But in a free market, they would not be obliged to pay for this public good. Consequently, rogue agencies funded by malevolent outlaws will have a much wider scope of operation under anarchy. Again, there are several possible replies to such a position. First, let us reflect that a large standing army ready to crush minority dissenters is not an ambiguously desirable feature of government. Second, the alleged problem of free riders would not be nearly as disastrous as many economists believe. For example, insurance companies would internalize the externalities to a large degree. It may be true that an inefficient number of serial killers would be apprehended if the relevant detective and police agencies had to solicit contributions from individual households. Sure, everyone gets a slight benefit from knowing a serial killer has been caught, but whether or not one person contributes probably won't make the difference between capture or escape. Yet, insurance companies that each held policies for thousands of people in a major city would be willing to contribute hefty amounts to eliminate the menace of a serial killer. After all, if he kills again, one of those companies will have to pay out hundreds of thousands of dollars to the estate of the victim. The same reasoning demonstrates that the free market could adequately fund programs to contain rogue agencies. Third, people need to really picture the nightmare scenario to see how absurd it is. Imagine a bustling city such as New York that is initially a free market paradise. Is it really plausible that over time rival gangs would constantly grow and eventually terrorize the general public? Remember, these would be admittedly criminal organizations. Unlike the city government of New York, there would be no ideological support for these gangs. We must consider that in such an environment, the law-abiding majority would have all sorts of mechanisms at their disposal beyond physical confrontation. Once private judges had ruled against a particular rogue agency, the private banks could freeze its assets up to the amount of fines levied by the arbitrators. In addition, the private utility companies could shut down electricity and water to the agency's headquarters in accordance with standard provisions in their contracts. Of course, it is theoretically possible that a rogue agency could overcome these obstacles, either through intimidation or division of the spoils, and take over enough banks, power companies, grocery stores, etc., that only full-scale military assault could conquer it. But the point is, from an initial position of market anarchy, these would-be rulers would have to start from scratch. In contrast, under even a limited government, the machinery of mass subjugation is ready and waiting to be seized. Conclusion. The standard objection that anarchy would lead to battling warlords is unfounded. In those communities where such an outcome would occur, the addition of a state wouldn't help. Indeed, the precise opposite is true. The voluntary arrangements of a private property society would be far more conductive to peace and the rule of law than the coercive setup of a parasitical monopoly government. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Fiat money is not out of thin air. Updated version of the article. I think it's important to use our language in a way that best expresses what we intend to say within the restrictions of truth. Penn Jillette, noted libertarian and juggler, has expressed publicly that he refuses to say marine mammals and instead insists on calling dolphins and whales fish. Jack Spierko, noted libertarian and rifleman, has said on numerous occasions that he doesn't make a big deal out of the difference between an ammo clip and an ammo magazine. These simple terminology variations don't matter in most situations. Both men are correct. That is, of course, unless you're a marine biologist speaking about the difference between whales, dolphins, and sharks, or if you're firing an M1 beside your buddy who's firing an M16 while asking you for ammo. Not likely scenarios, but you can see how these things take on a different level of importance according to the situation. Such is the case we face when discussing two key phrases, fiat and ex nihilo. Why would we care about these differences? Stick with me and maybe I can answer that question. Fiat roughly means something like so it is, or perhaps as it is. Either way, it's clumsy to say in English, thus we say it in Latin. What it actually means is to accept at face value in faith. It's very similar to when we say amen. It's a step in faith saying, I believe this to be so and will act accordingly. Ex nihilo, on the other hand, actually means out of nothing or from nothing or even from thin air. Most of the time, a distinction between these two expressions won't matter. That is, of course, unless you happen to be a theologian debating the creation of the universe, or an economist talking about the value of money. Then the difference becomes critical to the discussion. Fiat money is money backed by faith. But money has no set value. It only has the value we believe that it has in a particular situation. Let me give an example. Assume Bill Gates is standing in front of a coffee shop with a $5 bill in his hand. That $5 bill has a dramatically different value to Bill Gates than to the disabled man who's walking by and on a fixed income. And it has an even different value to the person inside the coffee shop who will accept it for coffee. To Bill, a cup of coffee is worth more than his 5 spot. But the man on the fixed income wouldn't think of paying $5 for a cup of coffee. However, the shop attendant will gladly give up a cup of coffee for the money. So now we have established the difference between the dollar amount printed on the paper and the actual value of the paper to the beholder. Now let's take the next step. What if it's not Bill Gates? What if it's Ben Stone and the bill he is holding is counterfeit? Not just any counterfeit, but a perfect counterfeit. Notice I said what if. What if Ben has a counterfeiting process that can produce any denomination of bill perfectly and at almost no cost? For the purpose of this demonstration, Ben cannot be caught and cannot be stopped. Let's say Ben produces a batch of money and comes into town. He spends $500 at a restaurant, then buys 2 new cars from the local dealership. On the way home from his shopping spree, he stops for coffee where he covers everyone's bill in the coffee shop and leaves a $100 tip for the shop owner. The effect of this act of counterfeiting is a sudden increase of wealth injected into a very narrow segment of the community, and a sudden devaluing of the money held by the rest of the community. We've already established that the value of the money is based on the perception of the beholder. Money is now easier to obtain and therefore less valuable to the restaurant owner, but just as hard to get for his other patrons and his cook. Money is now easier to obtain and therefore less valuable to the car dealership owner, but just as hard to get for the other car buyers and the auto mechanics. Back at the coffee shop, the owner may decide that now that he has this new big shot customer, maybe it's time for a price increase. After all, what's another dollar going to mean to a rich guy like Ben? He'll still buy the coffee. Ben is not producing money ex nihilo. Ben is producing money fiat. He is producing money with a perceived value based on what the people of the community believe. And as he does so, the value of the money in the community decreases. Prices go up, and wages are slow to respond if they change at all. Those on fixed incomes and those on hourly wages feel the squeeze of higher prices right away as their dollars are worth less and less each time Ben spends money. Again, Ben has not created money out of nothing. The value of the money is placed upon it by the perceptions of the community. Ben stole the value of the money from the low-end users of money in the community and redistributed it to Ben and the first users who received it. He did not create any wealth. Now let's change one aspect of this scenario. Let's say Ben's last name is not Stone. Let's say Ben's last name is Bernanke. When Ben Bernanke produces money, it is not out of thin air. Ben Bernanke produces fiat money through credit expansion, and when he does so, he does it at the expense of you. It is your wealth and the value of your dollar that is shifted upward to the top-end users. The bankers and the Treasury Department get the new money first, but the value of the money comes out of your pocket. Prices go up, and the poorest people in society pay the most for the credit expansion. Ben Bernanke doesn't produce wealth ex nihilo. Ben Bernanke produces money fiat. Ben steals the value of the money from the low-end users while enriching the high-end users. He does not create wealth. This is what Ron Paul calls an invisible tax, and it strikes those on fixed income and hourly wages the hardest, since they are the low-end users. So now, this begs a question. How is wealth created? Well, one example is when you take a seed, put it in the ground, and grow a tomato. You have invested one seed, mixed your labor with the energy of the sun, elements in the soil, and air, added time, and you produced wealth ex nihilo. Theologians, please sit down and stop screaming at me. I am not attacking your religion. I realize you don't use the phrase that way, but it is an accurate use of the phrase nonetheless. When you take a resource, invest time and labor, and produce something of more value than the sum of its parts, you produced wealth, ex nihilo. Here's the math. One pack of tomato seeds cost $1 and contains 50 seeds. Therefore, each seed is worth 2 cents. So, one seed worth $0.02. Sunshine, $0. Rain, $0. Air, $0. Dirt, $0. Time, $0. Yes, side note, time is money, but not to a tomato plant. Your labor, $0. Side note, I'm not saying your labor is worthless. I'm saying it costs you $0. Tomato price per pound at the store, $1. One plant can produce 8 pounds of tomatoes. So here's the equation. 0.02 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 0 equals $8. Therefore, by growing one tomato plant, you create $7.98 of wealth ex nihilo. That's downright inspirational, isn't it? For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Lies the State Taught Me, Part 1. FDR played us like a fiddle. Most American children suffer a prison sentence of 13 years in government schools. But fortunately, I was able to graduate a year ahead, so I only endured 12 years of indoctrination and institutionalized brainwashing. While in school, I consistently received my highest grades in classes involving history, geography, and civics. As weird as it sounds, in these subjects, I would usually read my entire textbook within a few weeks of it being issued to me, so most of the school year I was simply reviewing what I had already covered on my own. Of course, the class would almost never make it through the entire book during a school year, which means there were whole chapters the teachers rarely, if ever, saw. On more than one occasion, this practice put me at odds with the teachers, who made statements that directly contradicted the textbook. When I was very young, I would just make a mental note of such instances. But as I grew older, I became more bold and began pointing out the teachers' mistakes. By the time I finished serving the terms of my scholastic incarceration, I learned that there are three versions of history. There is the official one in the textbook, which is cartoonish and at times pure fantasy. There is the one that develops in the mind of people as they attempt to make sense of the textbook version. And there is that which actually happened, but must be discovered outside of the distortions of the first two types. One lie that was pushed on me by both textbooks and teachers was that the free market laissez-faire policies have been tried, and they failed over and over. In the 1800s, the free market caused monopolies, and robber barons got rich at the expense of the workers. In the early 1900s, the failure of the free market caused the Great Depression. and I was told that the free market had caused the recession of the 1970s and the ghettos and crime of the American cities. It was only through benevolent government intervention that we have survived the ravages of the greedy capitalists. In this twisted version of history, the state had tried to leave the economy alone, but every time the market would fail. And like John Wayne bringing the cavalry in at the last moment, the state had to swoop in and save the day. All facts were pushed aside by the textbooks and my socialist teachers, as the familiar good guys, bad guys theme was given as the driving force of history. And as always, no matter who the good guys were or who the bad guys were, it was the almighty state that solved the problem in the end. Another lie that was placed in such high regard that no one dared question it was the one where naive isolationism in the 1930s lulled America to become vulnerable and look weak, thus leading to the attack at Pearl Harbor. For me, this one was the first of the big lies that I just couldn't swallow. As a teen, I was fascinated by battle tactics, both land and sea, and the actions of the U.S. prior to December 1941 were clearly the actions of a strong navy baiting a weak navy into a first strike. If you read my article on Impossible Rules of Engagement, a link on site where this article appears, you'll see I grasped this tactic at an early age, and like the old saying goes, you can't trick a trickster. Let's pause a moment and question this sacred myth, using only the information I had at hand in the late 1970s. If America was isolationist, why did Roosevelt sign the Lend-Lease Act prior to the attack at Pearl Harbor? If America was isolationist, why did Roosevelt release active duty pilots, technicians, and instructors, along with a mini air force of planes and support equipment, to form the Flying Tigers and actively fight the Japanese in Burma prior to the attack at Pearl Harbor? If America was isolationist, why did Roosevelt break off oil and fuel sales to Japan prior to the attack at Pearl Harbor, then refuse to meet with the Japanese delegates on the matter? If America was isolationist, why did Roosevelt establish a separate, wide-sweeping embargo of Japan prior to the attack at Pearl Harbor? If America was isolationist, why did Roosevelt choose to garrison and fortify both Wake Island and Midway Island, along with moving the Pacific Fleet from the relatively safe San Diego Harbor to the exposed, bottlenecked Pearl Harbor? Each by itself an act of aggression in the eyes of Japan. Wouldn't any one of these acts by a U.S. president indicate to Japan that the U.S. was a threat and, in fact, preparing for war? And that being the case, wouldn't Japan fare better in the fight if it hit first and took out the Pacific Fleet? When I took these questions and others to my high school history teacher back in 1977, he scoffed at me. He contended that thinking like this is backward, and I will never understand history if I question the motives of the important leaders that have made America great. He refused to address even one of the central questions, but simply asserted that we must trust our elected officials because they know things the public is unaware of. Besides, looking back at history gives us perfect hindsight. We can't judge the decisions of people who were dealing with the situation as it happened. If they made mistakes, it was just that, mistakes. But I didn't believe this excuse. Roosevelt's actions were too close to the feigned innocence I utilized whenever I got into a fight. Again, see the article linked on this page. And As I look back on it, this smacks of the stupid or evil argument I address in this article, link again on this page. However, if it is true that the very president who is consistently hailed as one of America's greatest leaders was so stupid as to unintentionally send what was clearly a series of messages to Japan that we were on the verge of engaging them in war, why do we need buffoons like this at the helm of the state? If Roosevelt or any other person could be this stupid, why would we hand them the ability to go to war? As a final thought, I want to add a story an old sailor told me not long after I was out of school. He wasn't at Pearl when the attack took place because he was on a carrier support ship, and all the carriers had been pulled out and were, conveniently, safe. According to him, vacant sea orders had been issued just prior to the attack. He claimed that, had routine patrols been continued, ships would have spotted the Japanese fleet in time to bring the big battleships out of Pearl. My first thought was that the battleships would have had a fighting chance if they'd been at sea. But he corrected me. He said that without the carriers and their support ships, the battleships would have been sitting ducks in the open ocean and there would have been a dramatically higher death count. His argument was that by having all the big battleships in the harbor, most of the sailors were either safe on shore or could simply swim to shore when their ships went down. Whereas if they had been at sea, all hands on every battleship would have been lost. He also pointed out to me that almost all the ships lost at Pearl were actually only a few feet underwater and were pumped out and back in the war faster than their replacements could have been built. Every time he talked about it, he would get a little smile and say, FDR played us like a fiddle. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.